Welcome to the Amplifying Optimism in Education podcast, where we connect with educators from across the globe who are creating a better future for learning and educating now by implementing bold ideas and fostering a sense of curiosity, creativity, and possibility. Welcome to this week's episode of Amplifying Optimism in Education. I am one of your hosts, Michael Carson, here with my co-host, Joshua Faden. And this week's guest is Pamela Livingston Gaudette. She is the author of the new book, Like No Other School Year, which outlines how schools have successfully responded, adapted to the recent pandemic, and sort of some suggestions for a path forward. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Pam.
It's my great pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for asking me.
So, of course, and thanks for being here. And just to our listeners, we have a whole series coming up based on Pam's work and some of what she put together in the book. So, Pam, tell us a little bit about yourself and the book.
Sure, my pleasure. So, I have a background as a teacher and a tech director in schools. I've worked in schools. I had been in the tech world in New York City, and I moved to the education world, K-12, when my daughter was born, which is now 28 years ago, so it's a while ago, because I initially wanted to be on a schedule that would work better for having a child. And what happened along the way is I fell in love with K-12, and I said, I'm here forever. I'm not going back. I'm not going to, you know, have her graduate from high school and now go back to the tech world in that same way. So my entire career has been in K-12, either as a tech director or a teacher, or then I moved to developing K-12 products that are actually used by millions of students and teachers across the U.S. and internationally. When I moved to became a director of product for different large software development companies. The book was an interesting thing. I just left a very large company in November of 2019. And I was planning to do some consulting, and that kind of shifted around a lot when COVID happened. I couldn't really get the consulting I was looking for, and I couldn't really justify being the person to kind of come in and say, here, spend your money on me doing this for you, when obviously there's bigger fish to fry right now in the K-12 world. So I said, how could I add some kind of value? What can I do that would be helpful right now during this school closing all around the entire world? And I thought of when I was a tech director, what I would be doing during this time. And I realized that all around the entire world, there were tech directors on the front line, being the ones that had to bring devices to kids, make sure the internet worked, make sure that their LMS was up to date, find ways to send computers home to teachers and maybe students, deal with parents who were for the first time on the front line of this. And they were right in the hot seat. So I thought that I'd like to hear what their stories are. I came up with some open-ended questions. I actually added a few questions along the way. And I interviewed 32 educators at public, independent or private, Catholic and international schools. I interviewed more than that, but 32 are the interviews that became part of the book. And then I reached out to other people to help me with certain chapters that had specific expertise along the way. The title of the book, Like No Other School Year, was kind of a throwback to my thinking about my life as a teacher and as a tech director. And I always remembered the end of a school year and the beginning of a new school year as a really exciting time. You never quite knew what was going to happen exactly in September. And you started really anticipating that in, say, August. And so August of this year, I was thinking, oh my goodness, this is not your normal school year. It's not the normal end of a school year. It's not the normal beginning of the school year. Everything is upended. It is all different. Everything that you we're anticipating is going to be done differently. Everything that you expected would happen for students is going to be different, and for teachers and for parents. And so that's why I titled the book Like No Other School Year.
Yeah, I think that that's really, I've marveled before with you off the podcast, and so I'll marvel with you on this podcast about your ability to kind of have that foresight to kind of see the shift that's already that needed to happen and kind of go with it and allow the flow to take you where you need to go to be able to have these types of conversations. I'm curious, you know, you mentioned the open-ended questions and then some of the people that you've worked with. Can you talk a little about what you were hearing from those interviews and what themes arose that allows you to really think about the different chapters that need to go into this book?
There were kind of 12 learnings or themes. I'm not going to go to all of those because we have more time later to talk them in different podcasts. Sure. But the things that really came to mind right away was from all the public schools that I spoke to, their first concern was food emergencies, food insecurities, that these were students that they had that often had school lunch and maybe even breakfast 5 days a week, and suddenly no food. It's done. It's stopped. Not only that, these same students often didn't have devices, and a lot of them were pretty smart about not having devices. So they didn't have devices at home. Maybe they had a phone, but they didn't have anything else, but they got a lot of homework that had internet, right? And so then they would leave, either stay late at school, use the Wi-Fi at school, or sometimes they would go to McDonald's or Starbucks or their local library and use the Wi-Fi there and even the computers there. All gone, all stopped, all at the same time. So even the students who tried to deal with not having a device were stopped from any of their creative ways of doing homework. So that was the second thing. Digital equity was a big concern. And a lot of these schools were actually doing things like wiring computers off of computer carts and giving them out to parents, in some cases without even giving them a form to sign, because there just wasn't enough time. They were sometimes putting food on school buses and driving out to neighborhoods. And sometimes the school buses even had Wi-Fi devices on them, so that in addition to everything else, those kids in that neighborhood had a Wi-Fi device. So there were all sorts of creative things going on. It was a scramble. But I'll tell you, the thing that came out loud and clear was that they were stepping up to this plate. The people I interviewed were dedicated educators. That's why in the book I call them educators and not school leaders, because they led with their educator heart throughout this whole thing. And that they were concerned about the social, emotional health of their students, their teachers, and their parents. They realized that this was something that was like nothing that anyone has gone through. And, you know, you had to pay attention to social, emotional health as well. So those were two big learnings. And then the third big one that happened was that teachers stepped up. Some of these teachers had never, many of the places that the schools that I spoke to had never mandated the LMS. So we know that in the tech world that there are what we used to call killer apps, right? There's apps that everybody uses. In the school world, the killer app is the SIS, the Student Information System. Everybody has to have a student information system now. Then the next killer app was the LMS, the Learning Management System, but not every school district mandated the LMS. It wasn't necessarily required everywhere, and they didn't tell all their teachers to use it. But now the LMS was mandated, because how else were they going to give assignments to kids? How else were they going to track kids? How else were they going to understand what the work was and accept the work? They had to have an LMS, whether it was Google Classroom or whether it was one of the commercial LMSs out there, you know, other than Google Classroom, they had to do it. And many of these teachers had never, ever used an LMS. They were used to SISs and they used to whatever software they used, but not an LMS. And they had to quick learn that. They had to learn how to use the LMS, how to track assignments. They had to start using video software if this was what they were using for remote emergency learning. And all this happened very quickly, but every single one of the people that I interviewed, including the ones that weren't even in the book, said that their teachers stepped up, and they had huge respect and regard for their teachers, because teachers were doing what they know how to do, and that is taking the kids from where they are now to a better place.
It's really a Herculean effort that we're reviewing here from, you know, March and April and the spring and the summer that you kind of collect this data on. And I think, you know, I imagine that there are a number of schools out there who are probably still struggling with adopting an LMS, with figuring out social emotional learning and things like that. And so to those school leaders that might be listening, thinking like, what did that school do to kind of get the teachers up to speed, to kind of create and cultivate that community? What are some of the things just at a high level that you found schools were doing that really, you know, would help a school who might be still in an early phase with a lot of their teachers in terms of, you know, just scaling up for this whole online learning thing?
Yeah, this was a big thing that they were doing. And most all of them were checking in some way or another with all the families, which also uncovered another learning, which was a difficult part of things. A lot of these school districts and schools didn't have current information for their families. So they found out the hard way that the parents had moved, their phone number had changed, the contact information was wrong, they'd never tested it before. So the schools almost all reached out to their parent community to see how they were and how they were coping, and assigned their counselors. They put everybody to work. So the school counselors were often the front line with the parents and with the students as needed. Instead of being a school counselor, they were kind of a remote counselor. A lot of them had parent check-in times. A lot of them had teacher check-in times. They had times for teachers to come and share anything that they wanted to at all. And there would be a group of people at the other end on a Zoom meeting that were administrators, that maybe also tech people. So it wasn't just a tech support session. It was what do we need to solve for you? What do we need to get better for you? And there was just a continual check-in throughout this process. It also uncovered that some schools had kind of paid lip service to social emotional learning and social emotional health. Maybe they did a survey at the beginning of the year, and a lot of these schools did surveys throughout this whole process as well and are continuing to do surveys. But surveys aren't enough. Surveys need to have some kind of depth behind them. They have to have some kind of follow-up. It uncovered a lot of things along the way that schools thought that they had in place, but maybe weren't adapted to the level that they needed for this. And as far as the social emotional health and social emotional learning, I realized that we needed a chapter just on that. So I asked Ethan Delavan from the Bush School in Seattle to write that, and he did a great job writing that chapter.
Yeah, and he'll be a guest of ours later in the series that we're doing with Pam, so we're excited to talk with him as well. Pam, one of my favorite quotes from the book, it kind of speaks to what you're talking about here, is you say, a school is much more than buildings. It is also people who come together during a crisis. And many people saw the caring side of their communities during the pandemic. And I think that that really speaks to what you're talking about in terms of, when Michael asked for what can schools start doing, there's an entire chapter in your book about communication. You know, and I think the collaboration and the communication are so essential in the midst of a crisis, especially one of this scale. And so I'm curious if you can kind of, continue to elaborate on some of that communication and collaboration that was happening that you saw in some of the schools that were able to make this pivot.
Yeah, it was very necessary to have that communication. It was very necessary. People sometimes during a crisis have a tendency to draw back and not communicate and wait for the crisis to kind of unfold or resolve. But the reality is it's much better to over-communicate than it is to hold back. It's much better because if you do not communicate in depth with people exactly where you are and what's happening, people will fill in the blanks. And they won't fill them in with the best thoughts all the time. So it's very, very important that communication happen like that. Leadership behind that communication is really important. There just needs to be some kind of way that people feel like they know at least what's happening and where they are, and that there's places to call. There's so many different ways to do communication, and Mike Dougherty talks about that in that chapter. Different ways: there's email, there's texting, there's phone calls, there's your web page, lots of other things. Communication used to be a letter that went home from the superintendent to everybody in the school, but those days are gone. Communication needs to now be more interactive and more geared to what's going on. But you brought up the community. I want to say something about the community too aspect of things. So all these communities were suffering, and in different ways, the school became the hub of a lot of ways to solve issues for the community. And I think in particular of Jean at State College Area School District in Pennsylvania, where I actually used to live. There was just some amazing things that they did. They reached out to the community, and they helped with the food for the, not just for students, but for everyone in the community. They partnered with their local food bank. They found ways to, they had a number of parents who were not English speaking, and they partnered with the Penn State World Languages Program and found translators. They found diapers for families that needed them, because in addition to everything else that was going on, people lost their jobs all over the place, as we know. It wasn't just a school closing. It was a worldwide pandemic and a crisis and an economic crisis. And many of the schools became that central area for the community to go for help and to find out things and to get support.
You know, Pam, when it comes to communication and it comes to community, I think that I'm curious what your thoughts are on this. You know, tech directors or people in sort of the technology office, you know, maybe aside from the person that's more of just like the programmer or the gearhead, but, you know, tech directors tend to have a very unique ability to connect with a lot of people, because they are, you know, even before the pandemic, interfacing with pretty much everyone in the school and have times of the school year where, you know, without direct communication, without organizing communication, you know, there's no, they can't do their job. And so what are the, like, just drawing from your experience, you know, or what you observe in others, what are some of those kind of skills or even examples, you know, that maybe some leaders out there that are listening might kind of get some ideas for even how they can empower their tech director. Maybe people don't even realize that tech directors have these skills. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is a prime focus in schools now, and it used to be not. I mean, you know, it's one of those jobs that didn't exist, you know, what, I don't know, 40 years ago or
right,
something.
Exactly.
It didn't exist, right? I don't know how many years ago. But that now it's become, technology has become, it is the physical and the educational infrastructure for an entire school. It is the thread that holds things together. And so when a tech director has both a technology background, but also the heart of an educator, and I have to say that everyone I interviewed had that, they really thought like an educator,
yeah.
Then they will understand teachers, they will understand students, they will understand learning, and they will be moving into these different stakeholder communities in a way that other administrators don't. They do have to move through all these areas, and they have to be adept communicators and understanders of the life of a teacher and the life of a student and the life of a parent, and understand how they can help with that, and have the ability and the understanding to be able to lead in the middle of a crisis like this. I can't imagine, you know, they have to have all these skills, and all those skills were put to the test during the COVID pandemic crisis, which they had already developed. some of the tech directors said that they were right at the table of the school leaders that were planning everything. And that's where they should be. They should be right there. They shouldn't be, oh, and by the way, tell the tech director this. No, the tech director should be at the table. Well, lots of people should be at the table. Here, I'm going to veer off a little bit. The other people that should always be at the table is students. Students should always be at this table. We should give student agency everywhere. We should put them on committees. We should put them in decision-making areas. We should ask them, and not just by polls or surveys, we should ask them in person. They should be sitting there. When I used to teach, I was always asking my students things to make my teaching better. And every single time they were honest, they were forthright, and they came up with much better ideas.
Yeah, and I think that's, like you said earlier with community too, that's just a rule of thumb, I think, whether you're someone listening is a technology leader, a head of school, even a teacher, it's just reaching out to the people you're supporting. So if you're the technology leader, it's, you know, just checking in with a few teachers each day, even if it's like sending them an email and you only hear back from one
Absolutely.
Of them, things like that. Yeah. And, you know, I think just one little question on something you said, and that was, you know, there's, you know, those tech directors or those people in schools, maybe on the staff side, that are, you know, they do their job, but they're also educators at heart. What, you know, just, I kind of know what that means, but when you say educators at heart, what does that look like? What are the qualities of being an educator at heart?
I think that's a very good question. So it really means that the purpose of a school is to educate children, I mean, and young adults. That is the purpose of a school. And when a tech director truly understands that that is the purpose and that is their purpose to facilitate, I think they think differently. If you think your purpose is to keep the network running, it's not. That's not your purpose. The purpose is to serve out the tools and the resources and all the equipment and everything else that is needed so that education can happen and so that students have what they need and teachers have what they need. If you start thinking of it that way, you really realize that people are more important than machines, and you just think about it differently. I always told, when I was a tech director, we always said, teachers can always interrupt us. Always. Teachers can always interrupt us no matter what. I don't care if you're in the middle of rebuilding the network, a teacher can interrupt you. That is the priority. The priority is to make sure that students learn, that teachers have the tools, that parents can be part of this community, and not that the technology should never be the prime focus. The technology is the vehicle for learning.
And I think that it's an interesting shift that we're seeing, right? Because like you said, tech directors should always have been at the table, but in many ways the role had been kind of to pull schools along and try to say, hey, let's get some technology that we can use to assist our students and to help them with it. Now it is everything, as you said, and so they've gone from trying to pull along to being the leaders and to trying to help to educate everybody on what they need and how to use it. You know, I was at a school where we had all gotten brand new smart boards in every classroom, but we never were explained what that actually is and how to use it and why to use it. So you have a multi-$1,000 instrument there that is basically just hanging on the wall as an additional whiteboard. And yet it could be such an incredible tool. And I know that when I would figure out how to do an interactive lesson on it, and the kids would just go bananas over it. It was such an exciting experience. And so I think now we're kind of forced to have this creativity and this ingenuity on a regular basis if we want to produce the highest quality experiences for our students in this moment. So I'm curious if you could kind of speak to some of that interplay that's going on and some of the opportunity and creativity that is abound here.
I think it's a very important shift, and I think that you'll see a lot more titles that will say education technology or have learning in there, director of learning and innovation, and things like that. I think the word technology is going to eventually shift away, so it won't be in titles anymore. I think that tech directors or whatever they want to call themselves must be up on education. They must. So tech directors have to have an education understanding, And it's important for tech directors to use the language of the teacher, to understand the language of the teacher, to understand that they are the experts in the classroom, but that doesn't mean that the tech director can't become an understander of education and good pedagogy and good delivery of instruction. That should be on the tech director to learn those skills if they didn't already come up through teaching and learning, to learn that and to understand that, because everybody has to be on the same page and understand and have the same language.
Yeah. And as a, you know, former tech director myself, and I think, you know this, and this is what I say to the folks that might be not sure why that's important as a tech leader, or to the administrator that might not necessarily realize that, you know, engaging with the community instead of just, you know, focusing on the network all day or the, you know, fixing things all day, you know, it's like, you know, when you don't have support from anyone, everything is harder. So as a tech director, you know, connects and relates, it just, you know, then you're working with people that understand you. And that's, you know, just to kind of point out earlier, I think you said, and this, I think, would go for, you know, technology, social emotional wellness, all of the different student support services and teacher support services need to be at the table, because, you know, even on a normal school year, a lot of times school leadership thinks they understand what, say, the technology department needs to do. And they, you know, there's some back and forth, there's some friction there maybe to get that communication clear. I mean, that's on a normal school year. So, you know,
I think that background, this is a crisis like this draws upon whatever political capital you have gained already. And if a tech director has not been dwelling in the school in every way, for instance, I was on transportation committees. I had a lunch table in the middle school. I did a dismissal. I had study halls. I did all the things, and I actually would go to the school head or the principal and say, put me on your committee. And sometimes I'd be on some kind of a committee like transportation, and they'd say, "What? Why is technology here?" And I go, no, I'm here as an educator. I'm one of your colleagues. You know, I taught also. And I think it's so important to dwell in this and not to be away from it, and to walk around and to go into classrooms and to drop into the kindergarten and to drop into any place you will find as a tech director. You will know which teachers are okay with you dropping in. You'll find that out, you know, as you start at a particular school or district, and just keep dropping in and keep being there. Because when a crisis like this happens, that political capital will be drawn upon, because you will have the credibility and the understanding, and no one will say, "Why is tech here?" You don't want that. You want to be just at the table and a normal leader and even a normal educator with everyone else.
And I think we can say political capital, and I worked in Washington, D.C. private school, so I very much understand what political capital means in a school. But it's also doing what's right. And it's kind of, I think that's where, you know, for anyone in a school, even for a teacher, because I think that's where, you know, we're starting to kind of learn. And I think you're finding in this work that whether it's technology or even just really being more comfortable addressing social emotional issues as a teacher, you know, people I think are learning, and I'm curious what else you've seen in this regard. People are learning that, you know, okay, maybe I'm going to lose a few hours of class time, but like, you know, there's some really important things that have never really been addressed with some children that are really coming out that need to be addressed and things like that.
It's an opportunity right now. Now that, you know, remote learning is happening all over, you know, hybrid, blended learning is happening all over, it's a time to really look at your curriculum. So what are you teaching? Why are you having 30 kids in a classroom learning the Pythagorean theory? If 10 of them already know it, why are you putting them through that? Why not differentiate your instruction now? Certainly schools learned about online learning that you cannot just replicate this class schedule and the class day in front of screens. We know, but I mean, if I have a day that has 5 Zoom meetings and I have those days, I'm exhausted. I'm completely exhausted because I can't really function in other ways, mentally and physically and emotionally. Being in front of a screen that time, that long in a synchronous environment does not work. It's not good. So instead, why not take this time to really think about your content? Why not think about mastery-based assessment? Why not think about competency-based learning? Why not pull apart the curriculum into the specific areas that you want to learn and figure out who knows which of your kids and have them just work together on that. Put them in smaller groups. Have some asynchronous instruction. Meet with the smaller groups of kids. Meet one-on-one in small groups and then occasionally have the whole class together. This is a time that creativity can happen. And teachers are among the most creative people on the planet. I know that all over that this is happening. As long as we can really release the teachers right now and allow them to rethink their curriculum and rethink what's going to happen. When else would we have had this opportunity all at the same time, all around the world, to truly rethink scope and sequence and curriculum?
And priorities. I mean, I think you said it best, and you said, you know, even if tech directors aren't working in service of students, then they're not doing the job of an educator and of a tech director as one. And I think that as you said, we have this incredible opportunity now to really blend what we're learning using this technology that can allow us to, like you said, have one-to-one Zoom breakouts and do small group settings and use programs and have students keep track of their own learning and think about how do we move forward incorporating what we're learning now instead of it, you know, trying to be how do we retrofit what wasn't working and put it online, then how do we just go back to what wasn't working to begin with, but how can we actually use this to level up, as so to speak, you know, if you think about in terms of, you know, the next iteration of learning and the next iteration of education. So I'm curious, you know, one of the things that you always say is that this book isn't just a retrospective on what people went through. It's really about the recommendations and advice for moving forward. So I'm curious if you could kind of touch on some of that around, you know, what could it look like as we move forward here and figure out how to take what we're learning in this moment and continue it indefinitely.
Indefinitely, for sure. So, the book is written for, there's kind of a construct that is a school leader committee construct where there's little carrots in the book that start introduced in the beginning that school leaders probably all around the world, the U.S. and the world, are coming together now to try to debrief what's happened and try to move forward with what's going to happen next. So what can they learn from this time, and what can they learn from the educators that were interviewed and what was revealed? So there's a lot of questions at the end of each chapter for the school leadership committees to ask each other, to do surveys, to do focus groups, and to really rethink a lot of areas along the way. So some of the learnings, for instance, about social emotional health and leadership, about online learning. There's a whole chapter about online learning. So how is online learning going to happen? And then professional development, how is professional development going to be set up for success instead of just throwing teachers into a remote emergency learning like they were? Give them some professional development. But also, here we go, call the teachers and find out from the teachers exactly what they need and how they need it. Don't just have professional development that's about certain LMS and what button is here and how to do that and things like that. Talk about the pedagogy behind it. Just like your example of the smart board, nobody had really thought about the pedagogy and how to use this. And they maybe showed you some of the tools and say, oh, push here and then you can do this and you can do that. It's got to be, this professional development has to be meaningful. It has to be around the classroom. It has to be around the needs right now. This is a unique moment in time. This is completely unique in the world of education, that everything stopped all around the world at the same time, and now it's starting up in fits and starts. It's not even starting up all at the same time. You hear about a school district opening up, and then they come back and say, no, we're not opening up. And then they say, well, we're coming back in November. No, we're not coming back till the end of the year. This pandemic has not gone away. The it's a very sad thing. It's a sad thing for everybody. It's a, you know, people get sick, people die. It's terrible. And schools are trying to find their way through this. But there's an opportunity here to rethink everything right from the ground up, to rethink all the assumptions that you've got about school and the assumptions that you've got about learning. And what is school? What is school? Is it a community? Is it a vehicle for, is it an infrastructure? There's so many things that we need to consider now all at the same time. This is a major shift in the entire world, and shifts often happen and you know, history tells us 10 years later, oh, that was a shift. Well, we all know we're in a shift. So what are we going to do with it?
It's definitely a time, I think, for a lot of educators where there's not leadership to look to as for a lot of issues as well, you know, because leaders are busy, it's all new. So it really is, you know, it's a group, it's one heck of a group project for adults.
Yeah. And answers are emergent, right? So as you said, that's not like just that we don't necessarily have leaders to turn to, because there's no blueprint for this, right? We have never through this before.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that the idea of it being emergent and the idea of, you know, Michael, as you're saying, that who and how do we, instead of looking for others to turn to, how do we come together, as you're saying, I think is really important, because, you know, again, the way that we move forward, whether schools, we see an increase in online learning as they start to figure out how to do the asynchronous and synchronous combinations or hybrid learning, or we start going back to school, as we're saying, the idea here is rethinking what it can look like and how, as Pam said, what a school is, but also more important than that is what is learning and how do we learn and what can that look like?
And you know, it's such an, I mean, such an interesting time. You know, we have plunged students into remote learning. And what else are we doing remotely? Work. We're doing remote work all over the world. And that's shifting more and more. My husband works for a Department of Energy lab, and they keep telling him, well, you can go back to work at the end of the year. Now they say you can go back to work in the spring. There are remote work is happening all over. And now students are also learning remotely too. So in a way, we're setting up these students for the environment that they will inherit when they go on in their careers. But are we going to set them up the right way? You know, they need to learn the right way. They need to understand the right way to do video conferencing. They need to understand how to work with different groups in a video environment, which they never had to do before. There are a lot of skills that are emergent too. There's skills that are emergent in the K-12 world that have been done in work to a different degree, but now students are going to have this too. So in some odd way, I feel like these students are more prepared, getting more prepared for the work world than maybe they did before. And that might be a little controversial to think of, but at the same time, I think that they should learn what's appropriate to do on Zoom and video, and how to work in a group chat, and how to work in a Zoom breakout room, and what to say and what not to say. It's an opportunity to take over the world that's now moving more and more to remote learning and remote work.
Yeah, that element in there of digital citizenship and digital safety, and looking at this as just an opportunity to, you know, make sure that education happens. So Pam, it's been great talking to you. And I know we have a series coming up with some of the contributors to your book. So just kind of remind us, who is the book written for? Who are some of the contributors that we'll be talking to? And any pieces of wisdom that you wanted to get in today? I know there's a lot of information to share.
So the book was really written for school leaders that are trying to make sense out of what happened because of COVID during the time when schools were closed, and for what's happening next, and to try to give them some of the tools to move forward, to ask the right questions, to think about the right things, to make sure that the following the different components are in place as they move forward with a new plan that based on what how learning is going to change because of the pandemic for the future. Because we don't know how long this change is going to happen. But we do know that out of all the people that I interviewed, all of them said the same thing. We do not want to go back to the same instructional methods from this. We don't. We are doing online learning, and we're going to continue to do online learning. So there's different chapters in the book about social emotional health, and that's written by Ethan Delavan, and he's very up on this, and he's at the Bush School in Seattle. There's a book. There's a chapter rather on leadership by Scott McCloud, who is really renowned as a professor of education technology, specializing in K-12 leadership. And so he talks about his podcast, The Corona Chronicles, as well as a course that he taught over the summer on crisis management. There's a chapter, again, on communication that we talked about a little bit. There's one about online learning written by Lindy Hockenberry, who spends her entire time doing professional development with teachers, and she brings up some really great points. It's a synthesis of an ebook that she's written that Lindy and I excerpted for the book. There's also a chapter on cybersecurity and privacy written by the Atlas people. Atlas is an organization for tech directors, and they are really spot on about some of the things. But all of these things came out of what the 32 educators I talked to spoke to me about, what they needed to have in place, what they were glad they had in place, what they wish they had in place. Along the way, for instance, infrastructure was one of the big things that a lot of the tech directors said, well, we already have one-to-one and we were a lot better off. And then some said, we didn't have one-to-one. We were taking laptops off of carts and we were going and buying Chromebooks. They also found out that schedule was a big, big thing, that you cannot take the schedule that goes from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. and suddenly turn it into a remote learning environment. It doesn't work that way. And then they also found out that students were resilient. So I think that the book can be kind of a handbook of the changes that are coming. I think we need to learn somewhat from the past. This is a very recent past, and this is educator stories. And I think we can use those stories to help the change that's coming next.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. And you know, as I said, I've read the book. I love the book. I think it's so useful on so many different levels. And as you said, whether you're a school educator in any form, right? So whether you're the tech director, the principal, the teacher, a parent at this point, the students themselves, I think we all benefit from the knowledge, the information, the recommendations and resources that you've compiled incredibly into one place. And so I think that our listeners would really get an incredible value from this book. Again, Like No Other School Year by Pamela Livingston Gaudette. Tell us where they can reach you to continue the conversation. How can they purchase the book? We'll obviously put a link to it on our website and in the description of this episode. But Pamela, how can they continue the conversation with you and just continue their learning in this moment?
I would love to hear from people. I love to talk to educators. I love to talk to school leaders. It would be my pleasure to speak to them. You can get this on Amazon. You could even just search on Like No Other School Year and it'll come up. It's either an ebook or a paperback. And I have a new web page, likenootherschoolyear.com. I'll give you that link for that. And you can contact me through that. And I'm always happy to talk about this. This is my passion. K-12 has been my passion ever since I moved to the K-12 world. And I think that technology, when used well, can enhance teaching and learning. And I think that it can be a vehicle for student agency.
Thank you, Pamela Livingston Gaudet, for sharing your wisdom and your work with us, author of Like No Other School Year and Lifelong Educator. Thank you, Pam. And to our listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode with Pamela and that you'll share this episode with colleagues. Subscribe to our email list in the show notes to find out about upcoming episodes and workshops. Coming up next, a short description of a town hall meeting where Pamela will be speaking more about her book and answering questions. It will be hosted by the Atlas Organization. And so without further ado, here is Pamela along with Susan Davis, the Professional Development Director for Atlas.
Atlas is an organization that's been around for about 6 years. So, you know, in organization terms, we're kind of adolescent, I would say. And it was designed to support particularly anybody who might consider him or herself a technology leader in an independent school. So we see these as somewhat different from the needs of technology leaders or people who lead technology in public schools. But there is some crossover and certainly ways for both groups to learn from one another. But technology in, leaders in independent schools tend to do the whole shebang. You know, they touch every aspect of technology in the school rather than overseeing some smaller piece of that in the district. And so that's why we came into being, to provide the kinds of resources and the networking for those people in the world in which they live and work.
That's terrific. And I'm so pleased that you've invited me to be a guest on November 11th at your town hall. I was kind of wondering, for our listeners, what might they get out of the experience of attending an Atlas town hall?
Yeah, the virtual town halls came into being right when everybody went home due to the pandemic. And so at one point we were doing these town halls every week because basically we felt like it was our job to create space for these leaders in our community to come together and solve the problems that were in front of them. And so it's usually a somewhat informal structure, sort of depending on what are the needs of the moment. And we've seen these evolve over the course of time. We went to 1 month starting in, you know, monthly town halls starting in the summer. But, you know, we've evolved with the needs of the leaders as they face them. And so we might have some idea of what the people are going to bring to the table. It's a meeting. It's not a webinar. It's open to everyone who can come in, ask a question, turn off their camera and eat their lunch, whatever they want to do. But it's really a place for, you know, the thought leaders in our community to come together and solve problems. And other people just sort of listen in on that process.
Wonderful. I've invited some of the interviewees to attend, so you may have a few of them there, and I might just say hello to them in the chat, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And so we've invited Pamela to come and share just a little bit at the beginning of our town hall coming up next week on November 11th. We've invited her to come in and share about her book and how it came together. And then, you know, take part in the conversation as it evolves. I can share the Atlas website, which is theatlis.org. And the other website that you may need, this is a little easier, bit.ly/ATLIS VTH, virtual town hall, and that will allow you to register. Once you register once for the virtual town hall, you will get an invitation to all the other virtual town halls and an even more informal version of get-togethers that we have with our community called Atlas Office Hours.
Josh and I hope you enjoyed listening to this week's episode of Amplifying Optimism in Education. Please join us next week for another new episode and conversation with an innovative educator from around the world.